Why, thank you, Pete. I think you may be a little bit biased, but I receive it nevertheless. Happy New Year, everyone. It was so great to hang out at Vision Sunday and to hear everything that's happening. And amazing, really, because we probably had quite a broad overview, Pete and I, of most of those things, but hearing them in swift succession absolutely blew us away on Sunday morning. And also just knowing the number of people in the life of the church who give up time to volunteer and invest into the many, many things that are happening. We're so grateful for you. So just say to yourself this morning, I am loved. You are. You're very, very loved. I get to introduce our new theme for the foreseeable, and it's on the back of last week. We unveiled a vision, which in one sense is nothing new, but in another sense, we want to demystify it somewhat. We are going to be intentional as a church in 2024 about becoming disciples and about making disciples. And so our new teaching theme is The Way, and it's our opportunity to equip each other and to equip you to follow life Jesus's way, to embark upon that journey. John 14, verse 6, we know that Jesus himself said, you know the way to where I'm going, because I am the way, the truth, and the life. So what does it mean for us to live life following Jesus's example? That's what we're going to be unpacking. And I think that when it comes to the word discipleship, there's just so much stuff. I made the mistake, or perhaps you could say I had the genius idea, of Googling the word. And honestly, the first list was 8 keys to discipleship, the 4 foundations of discipleship, the 12 truths of discipleship, the 15 principles of discipleship. And as I looked, there were some overlaps, but it feels to me that everybody has got a different take on what discipleship looks like or means. And that's baffling, isn't it? Because when we're thinking about actually how to live life as a disciple, the more information that we've had, probably the more confused we've become. And I'm pretty certain that the Jesus way is not as complicated as we have made it as churchgoers over the years. So my job today is to demystify it. And what I'm hoping to do is to take all of the baggage that we have accumulated over many years, lots of which is helpful baggage, right? I'm not saying it's not needed, but I'm just saying that actually sometimes it's overcomplicated and made something so complex that should be so simple. So I'm going to be talking about the Jesus way as we start today. And this really is just a teaching moment to frame for us, what does it really mean to be a disciple? And if you have been following Jesus for years and you think, oh, come on, Nikki, I know all of this, trust me, there'll be some things in here that maybe you didn't know. So here we go. What is discipleship? I think it's probably more helpful to ask the question, what isn't discipleship? And I'm going to give you a list of things, and discipleship may well include and encompass everything I'm about to say. But in and of themselves, these things are not discipleship. Are you with me? Okay. So it's not a course. It's not a program. It's not a tick box exercise. It's not static. It's not a one-time thing. It's not a quiet time or a daily devotion. It's not the great book, podcast, or message you listen to this week. It's not being part of a small group. It's not a Bible study. It's not a prayer meeting or a regular prayer commitment. It's not attending the gathering on a Sunday. It's not accumulating more information. It's not an individual pursuit, but it may include all of those things. Oh, okay. We're used to doing all of those things, aren't we? And they may contribute to our discipleship journey, but that is not the essence of discipleship. In fact, I would say that in this day and age, we're more information-rich, content-rich, and resource-rich than we've ever been. And yet, arguably, the church in the West is so impoverished when it comes to becoming disciples and making disciples compared to the church in other parts of the world. Why is that? John Mark Comer puts the crisis like this: the modern church is facing a crisis of discipleship. It's not that people don't want to become like Jesus, or that people aren't trying to become like Jesus. It's that we don't know how to become like Jesus. We need a pathway to formation for the modern era. What a brilliant quote, and I think it's true. So, what is discipleship? It's a learning journey, a pilgrimage, a relationship, a lifelong commitment to walk as Jesus walked, to follow in his footsteps, to do what he did, to live as he lived, and to love as he loved. Life the Jesus way, this journey, this walk, this learning. And I want to strip it right back to the basics today. And I'm sure that other people along the way in this teaching theme will add all the extra nuance. But I want to strip it back to its purest form, and I want to identify just three characteristics today of what a disciple should look like. And the first is this: we should be learning. If we're a disciple, if we're a follower of Jesus, then we should constantly be learning. Jesus says this in Matthew 11:29. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And if you take a look at the Greek word for disciple in the New Testament, it's mathetes. And it basically means a learner, a student, or a pupil. But it's not just a pupil or a student as we would understand it now. Nowadays, if you think about students, you can, you know, you might be learning online individually. You might be attending lectures or seminars or courses to learn. Discipleship back in biblical times, in first century Judaism, looked really different to that. It was an adherent, someone who literally stuck to their rabbi and closely followed them, who was devoted to and abided with and did life with their rabbi. Listening to their teaching, yes, but not just acquiring knowledge. It involved a special relationship, and relationship was pivotal and vital to discipleship in the early church. I looked this up beautifully. Oh, there you go. That's the Greek word. Sorry, I'm not following with my slides very well. I looked it up in Wikipedia, and it's not often that Wikipedia tells me something really beautiful about Jesus, but check out this quote, because I loved it. A disciple in the ancient biblical world actively imitated both the life and teaching of the master. It was a deliberate apprenticeship which made the fully formed disciple a living copy of the master. We're supposed to be living copies of Jesus, living copies of the master. It feels like a tall order, doesn't it? But let's just dive into some Jewish history, because back then, when Jesus called the first disciples, Jewish girls and boys would go to school for the first time at around 6 till about the age of 10. But they didn't learn shapes and colours and how to engage with one another socially necessarily. They learned the Torah at the local synagogue, taught by the local rabbi. And the first level of education, as I said, was until around the age of 10. At which point, most kids would no longer still be going to school. They would go back home to learn the family business or trade. For girls, that would look like managing a household. For boys, it would look like apprenticing their father's trade or business. Now, the best portion of that first batch, up to 10, would stay on to learn some more. They would go on to the next level, and this would be an in-depth study of religious laws, Jewish theology, and the written collection of the oral traditions of the Jewish people, because remember, discipleship and formation happened by and large through telling stories, through passing stories from one generation to the next. They also had to memorize Genesis to Malachi. Who's got that down? Anyone? No, me either. I feel a little challenged by that. And from there, only the absolute best of the best would continue on to the final level, which was called Beit Midrash. And at this point, the student would go to a rabbi and apply to be his disciple, to do what the rabbi did, to know what the rabbi knew. And the disciple would pick out the rabbi that they wanted to follow. And the reason for that is that each rabbi interpreted the Torah, the scriptures, differently and applied the scriptures differently according to his own set of discipleship beliefs and practice. And get this, that set of discipleship beliefs, that interpretation of the scriptures, was called the rabbi's yoke. It was called the yoke. It was a metaphor for the rabbi's worldview, the way he saw God and the way he interpreted and lived out scriptures. And every rabbi had a yoke. Some rabbis had a really hard, burdensome yoke. Others had a slightly less so. And they expected their students to live by that yoke. So the disciple would pick out the rabbi they wanted to follow, and they would take the rabbi's yoke, teaching, interpretation of the scripture, upon them to learn what he knew, to do what he did, to be like he was. Now, when Jesus says, "Learn from me, take my yoke upon you," that's what he's talking about. He's saying, come, follow me and learn from me. Do what I do. Hear how I interpret the scriptures for you. You have heard it said, but I say, and whatever it is. And it's radical because Jesus' yoke is steeped in gentleness and humility. And his yoke is easy and his burden is light. I don't think that sounds like a lot of the discipleship that we've grown up with in church. Let's be honest. The thing that puts us off most is it feels so onerous. But Jesus didn't intend his yoke to be that way. Now, disciples of a rabbi back in biblical times would have memorized the rabbi's words and adopted his interpretation of the scriptures. The rabbi would test a would-be disciple comprehensively, and if he wasn't found worthy, he would be dismissed to go and learn the family trade. But those he found to be the creme de la creme, the absolute elite, he would say, come on, follow me. And at that stage, the 15 or 16-year-old boy would leave his friends, his family, his village, his synagogue, to devote his entire life to learning to be like his rabbi, watching, imitating him, walking behind him when he entered a town, literally covered in the dust of the rabbi. And there was this process of learning. And I think it's interesting because when we think about what it means to be a disciple, I'm pretty sure that all of us would say that believing in Jesus would be an important part of being a disciple. And absolutely, believing in Jesus is the thing that causes us to seek him out and say, hey, I want to come and follow you. But what I think we fail to understand and that we grossly underestimate time and time again is just how much Jesus believes in us. You see, when it comes to our learning and apprenticeship as disciples, Jesus chose the uneducated, the rejects. He chose the ones who'd been sent back to the shore. They didn't make it to the Beit Midrash. They were there fishing, learning their father's trade, doing that stuff. And they didn't choose him. They didn't go through the application process. No, he came and sought them out and he chose them. Jesus flipped the process of learning upside down and on its head. And he left the future of the church in the hands of this motley bunch of young people. That's how much he believed in their capacity to learn from him, to imitate him well, to teach others his ways. That blows my mind. So if you're one of the ones who didn't do well in school, if you think that you don't know your Bible well enough, if most of the time you think you don't represent Jesus well, don't underestimate how much he believes in your potential to learn from him and to become like him. He believes in you more than you will ever believe in yourself. There's growth implied in the discipleship learning journey. And how do we learn? I used to be a teacher, and there's many, many learning styles, but generally you can boil it down to three: listening and hearing, watching and seeing, doing, and action or activism. And learning comes often by repetition, by imitation, or by just getting hands-on and getting involved. And we all have a slight leaning as to how we learn best. But there's a growth mindset required to be a learner in the kingdom. I've been doing a lot of work with my eldest daughter on the growth mindset work, which I wish someone had done with me as a child. Fixed mindset says, I'm not, delete as appropriate, enough. I'm not qualified enough. I'm not clever enough. I'm not theological enough. It says, I'll never. I can't. It's too hard. Versus a growth mindset which says, I can't do it yet, but I'll get there. I can learn how to do it. A journey with Jesus, my friends, is called to be a lifelong process of growth. And for that, there is a degree of humility and openness required. I think that's why Jesus says, I'm humble of heart. There's this thing that as we learn from him, we have to have a humility and an openness. And I think that really sadly, if I was to diagnose a major problem that we have, particularly in Western church, but I'm sure not exclusively, is that we all think that our way is the right way. We all think that our understanding of the scripture is the only one. There's very, very little opportunity for us to say, I could be wrong. But I think that's a prerequisite for being a disciple of Jesus, this openness to say, I may not have this right. We're all learning. We should all be learning. And it doesn't matter how old you are or how long you have been following Jesus. It takes courage. It takes discipline to be vulnerable enough to say, I'm open to new ideas. I'm open to new ways of thinking and doing it. And for years, my friends, the Western church has felt it's the teacher called to apprentice to other parts of the world in the ways of discipleship, the true ways, the only ways. But perhaps part of God's wisdom in this age that we are living in now is that we need to discover the humility to learn from other believers in other parts of the world. Take a look at the global south, where the church is exploding. It's seeing things that we are not seeing and coming alive in ways that we, by and large, are not. Of course, there's still a mission field beyond our shores. But it's fair to say that other nations have been sending missionaries to Europe and the UK for quite some time in the hope that the church in this nation, with a capital C, will stop declining and start teeming with life. Lifelong learners. This is the way. But it's not just this is the way, because I think that's part of the problem. We all want to tell everybody this is the way, but Jesus doesn't say this is the way. He says, I am the way. And there's a very, very important distinction. It's not a set of instructions to complete. It's not a formula. It's not a method. It's an ever unfolding process of development and formation. And that's why it's really dangerous to freeze frame someone as the Christian that you knew them as 5 years, 10 years ago, because we should all be growing and evolving. And so much damage is done when we just pigeonhole someone into a wacky box or a heretical box or whatever kind of box we want to put them in. We shouldn't freeze frame, because we should be moving in this learning journey. I am the way. It's not simply information, but imitation. It's more than a lecture or a degree course. It's a lifelong apprenticeship. And there's a need for commitment consistency and community when it comes to this learning journey. Little and often. The big gestures are great, and I'm sure Jesus loves them. But what he's really looking for is just little consistent changes over time. We can't do it alone. There is beauty in peer learning. And as a teacher, I can tell you that every single time, it was in those moments of peer learning that my kids would pick up something fresh or new and exciting. There's something so powerful about us learning together in community. So listen, the older you get, statistically, the harder it is to learn new things. We become less receptive to new ideas and ways of thinking, new technology, or new perspectives. Statistically, our learning tends to plateau from somewhere in our early 20s, this is really depressing, through to 70, where it actually begins to decline. Our fluid intelligence peaks in our early 20s and declines from there. So can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's generally agreed that this statement doesn't have to be true. But it's worth pointing out that more often than not, we are fighting the cultural tide when it comes to openness and learning the older we get. Think about the algorithms that feed us new information that very neatly aligns with our current opinion, stance, and entrenches us only further within it. That's a challenge. Want to be like Jesus? Want to be a disciple? It's time to learn, my friends. The next characteristic that I would put it to you is pivotal to being a follower of Jesus is quite obviously following. Jesus' invitation in Mark 1:17, 2:14, John 1:43, and several other examples is follow me. Mark 1:17, Jesus said to them, follow me and I will make you become fishers of men. Mark 2:14, and as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. It's not a glamorous moment, but there's movement implied in following. There's something about not staying still, not stagnating, not retreating. We shouldn't be plateauing in this journey. There's a sense of being led, being guided, step again, just do the next right thing, says Anna in Frozen Tea. So it begs the question, who are you following? Who am I following? Because truth be told, we're all following something or someone, and often multiple people at one time. We follow ways of life. We follow sets of beliefs, cultural customs, person or people, influences. Who do you look up to? Who do you admire? What you read, how you spend your money, your social media likes or follows, your political stance, your upbringing, your family, all of these things point to who you follow. Now, when I was at school, our science teacher every year used to collect some duckling eggs from a local farm. And in the science labs, there would be an incubator, and each egg had a different colour on it. And we would go down in our lunch break and we would take a look, waiting for these ducklings to hatch. And then the day would come when they did. And because they didn't see their duck mum, which is sad and tragic in itself, but they saw Mr. Houston, our science teacher, who was always there, poised and ready. What would ensue in the following weeks is that we would watch Mr. Houston walking down the corridor at school, and behind him would be a gaggle of little ducklings following him wherever he went, and they would each have a different felt tip colour on their head so that he could distinguish them. He didn't name them, they just all had a different colour. And they would be walking behind him. It was the cutest thing ever. Apparently, when ducklings hatch, first person or thing they see that moves, they follow, which is usually their own mum. But in this case, it was Mr. Houston. We're called to follow Jesus wherever he goes, into the unknown, through valleys, through challenging terrain. It's going to take courage. It's going to take energy. Are we called to carve our own path? Look, I love that phrase because I'm all about pioneering and trailblazing, and I get it. We don't just want to conform to the pattern of this world. But actually, when it comes to following Jesus, we're not called to carve our own path. There's a vulnerability and a humility, as I said, required to follow him. It means my life and my trajectory are no longer solely in my own hands. I've surrendered it to him. It doesn't mean I don't have an active part to play in it. Of course, it doesn't mean I don't have choices. I don't become a robot. But it does mean that I'm leaning in. I'm watching where he's leading me, and I'm following him where he takes me, rather than carving out my own preferred path. And it's a pathway that's been trodden for generations by followers of the Jesus way. But inevitably, as the disciples took up the call to follow Jesus, it automatically meant there were things they were leaving behind. And the mark of a disciple is not only their capacity to follow, but it's also the costly moment of denying ourselves and leaving some stuff behind us. You see, following is a yes to Jesus, but it's also a no to some other things. There are people, habits, situations, skills, trades that we might leave behind in order to follow the call of Jesus. Those first disciples left their nets and their livelihoods, their families and their communities to follow Jesus, to move forward and keep moving forward in pursuit of him. And so it must be for us. Simultaneously to saying yes, there must be a willingness to let go of where we are, where we're comfortable, where we're familiar, and follow the Jesus way, letting go of attitudes, habits, and things that hold us back in the process. Difficult roads lead to beautiful destinations. We're called not only to follow once, but to keep following. And for some today, I feel that Jesus wants to say this: you didn't come this far, my friends, to only come this far. There's more to come. Now, when it comes to following and discipleship, one of the biggest things that we need to kick out today is heavy shepherding, right? Some of us will have come from church backgrounds where we saw the absolute worst of what it looks like to be discipled. Someone that basically took it to mean you are controlled by an individual who's high up in the church and powerful. That is not what we're going for in Skylark Church, and it's not really a very kingdom model. So my advice for you is this: if you want to be a disciple, you need to follow Christ first. Look, Joyce Meyer's brilliant. Love Rob Bell. There are some really wonderful theologians and teachers out there. But Jesus is our rabbi. Jesus is the one that we said yes to. He will be there when all of those other people are no longer around. We cleave first and foremost to him. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, Apostle Paul says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." So the foundation is, first of all, let's just imitate Christ. And then we might want to get on to imitating people who are imitating Christ. When it comes to that, yes, it's good for us to be discipled by someone who's a little bit further along in their journey. It should look like that person walking alongside you and assisting you to think for yourself, to pray for yourself, to hear his voice for yourself. But how do we select a person to disciple us? How are we going to avoid that hideous control that we've all seen happen in other church cultures, or maybe even at times in this one? My advice would be this: follow those who look like him and live like him. Paul says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." Does that person have a track record of imitating Christ? Do they sound like him? Do they live like him behind closed doors? You need to be able to trust that person. Watch and see what they model for a while. And on that note, we're not looking for perfect. No one's perfect. Jesus is perfect. That's why we're called to follow him. But no individual on this planet, however much they may sound like Jesus, is perfect.